On a Thursday, this is Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And my name, friends, is Avi Wolfman Aaron. So glad to have you with us on this Thursday, this chilly, rainy Thursday.
I know.
But we're warming you up with a good conversation, correct?
Yes. And I can say this on behalf of Avi. We are excited.
We are.
Because today we have a very cool interview airing. Our chat with North Philly native, basketball phenom, the one and only Dawn Staley. I was giddy. We were both very giddy when we got this interview. We were like very giddy.
No, I was very professional. What are you talking about?
But we were professional in the interview. But if you don't know who she is, I mean, 4 gold medals, 3 national championships, 2 player of the year awards. She's a Hall of Famer, 5-time WNBA All-Star, as well as a WHYY Lifelong Learning Award recipient.
Oh, you threw that in there. Nice.
2022.
Nice.
But she grew up in the projects in North Philadelphia, right near 25th and Diamond. And she honed her skills on the court at her local rec center and in her neighborhood. And she talks all about her North Philadelphia roots in her new memoir, Uncommon Favor, which dropped this week. And she'll actually be in Philadelphia on Friday, which is tomorrow.
Yeah.
For a live event at Enon Tabernacle Church, but we got to talk to her, and I can't wait for you to hear that interview. And the question we have for you today is this: do you have any personal memories of Coach Staley to share from the neighborhood, from her time at Dobbins, from Temple, beyond? Has she inspired you? You can give us an email at studio2@whyy.org. And for those of you watching on YouTube, I think we have it on YouTube today. Yes, you can drop your comments in the chat.
And also, it's Thursday.
Yes.
So DJ of the day is in play. So I guess we're going to look for a song that is in the basketball North Philadelphia winning category, whatever you think connects to Coach Dawn Staley. Submit your song. We're going to pick one song to end the show on today, and we'll shout out your name if we pick your song. Of course, we don't pick. Producer Paige picks, and you can reach her by emailing studio2@whyy.org. That's studio2@whyy.org. Get in your submissions for DJ of the day.
I can't wait to hear what songs people have.
I think it's a
basketball, North Philly. It's so
many
things.
Sort of a tricky one.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Basketball, winning, North Philly.
Yeah, I bought those up.
You know,
I don't know. Not a lot of songs spring to mind for me.
Yeah, I would do like a women power song. I feel like when I think about Dawn Staley,
that's
I think about,
idea.
You know, strong women, women power,
yeah,
girl power.
Yeah, for sure. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's good. I hadn't thought about that angle.
Mm-hmm.
While you guys brainstorm on all that, we're going to start with our trio of local news stories. And we're going to start with the weather. Does it feel weird to you?
It does. A little chilly.
It should feel
rainy.
Weird. It should feel weird.
Mm-hmm.
Because the East Coast right now is experiencing a nor'easter.
Oh.
And we rarely see nor'easters in the month of May. The Washington Post says there have been just 2 other May nor'easters in the last 35 years. Those big rainstorms that churn up the eastern seaboard. The blame here lies with a heat dome. You love heat domes, right, Cherry?
Yeah, tell me what it is. Yeah,
I don't want to go too deep down that. You know, I know, but I don't want to say.
Mm-hmm.
There's a heat dome over Iceland that is driving cold air south, creating the conditions for this nor'easter. But here's where I was fascinated when I was reading this Post story. So I knew what a nor'easter was.
Mm-hmm.
I'm familiar with the weather pattern. I did not know that much of our early knowledge of nor'easters and that weather pattern comes from a Philadelphian.
Okay. And guess, I know I can guess. I kind of know. But tell everybody.
The one and only Benjamin Franklin.
Yeah.
He invented everything, including apparently nor'easters.
Genius. Yeah. I mean, he probably, I wonder if he named, did he name nor'easter?
It didn't say in the story. I'm not
but
sure.
But he discovered them. Yeah.
That doesn't feel like a very Ben Franklin name to me, nor'easter.
Yeah, it doesn't.
That feels like mid-19th century, like Herman Melville, maybe.
Yeah,
something
maybe.
In Moby Dick. There blows a nor'easter.
But I always think about everything has a Philadelphia tie.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
well, especially on this show.
Yeah, I love it. I love it. By the way, I was nervous because of this nor'easter, because my little plants, you know. But I looked it up, and as long as the temperatures do not go under 50... they're going to be okay.
Long.
Under 50, you have to cover them and kind of protect them.
Okay. Long live the plants. Okay. Story two.
Yes. The Philadelphia Housing Authority is launching a very ambitious $6.3 billion decade-long plan. It's the most aggressive expansion for that agency since the 1960s. If you didn't know, PHA is led by Kelvin Jeremiah, and their plan is to seek an overhaul of 13,000 of PHA's properties, build 3,000 more units, and purchase an additional 4,000 units in private sector buildings. That's a lot of things to do in a decade. And Jeremiah spoke with the Philadelphia Inquirer for a deep dive interview, and he called this an advantageous moment. But a lot of folks are saying, how are you going to pay for this, Kelvin Jeremiah? I mean, there's inflation, there's high interest rates, increased costs of construction, plus the Trump administration is in power right now, and they're all about cuts, including to HUD, right? And so Jeremiah said he is undeterred. He says if you can't build new units, they'll acquire more units, but they do plan to move forward. And I got to say this, PHA has 100,000 people on the wait list. Yeah. So it's a pretty big deal. They have 64,000 units that they need
to meet the demand.
And so there's a lot of work to be done.
Yeah, this was a great story, by the way, in the Inquirer with some history on PHA that I didn't know. So like one thing I learned, for instance, is that at one point they had as many as 21,000 units. But a lot of that was contained in these big high-rise towers that had all sorts of problems that people didn't like. So when they went through a reform in the 90s and in early 2000s to raise a lot of those towers, they got probably better quality housing, but fewer units. And they've been at this 13,000 unit level for a while. The other super interesting thing that I read in this piece by Jake Blumgart, by the way, in the Inquirer, is that one of their strategies here is to buy up these private units that have been overbuilt in certain areas of the city, some gentrifying areas, for instance, and they buy those at a discount from the private landlords who can't make the profit they were expecting to make. And so there's this downstream effect of housing that was built for, you know, the market rate and now ends up potentially as public housing. I didn't know that that pipeline existed. And apparently Kelvin Jeremiah is focused on expanding that pipeline. Super interesting. So I think it's just a nice primer on PHA in general.
Yeah, and he's been very busy. He was hired in 2013. And he's been working for 12 years now.
And PHA had a bad reputation at that time.
He's been transforming the agency. So anyway. Moving on to a little bit of a...
Yeah, more a look in the past and a look in the future here. There was a nice photo essay today in the New York Times about drive-in movie theaters. And they are a dying breed. Fewer than 300 remain across the country. The story happens to mention that drive-ins, and I'm a little ashamed. I did not know this. Drive-ins were invented in New Jersey.
Another local tie.
Specifically, South Jersey. A Camden man named Richard Hollingshead patented the idea for a drive-in movie theater. Shout out to Richard.
He
patented the idea in 1933 and opened the first one. You need a patent.
Yeah,
that was
cool.
His idea.
Smart guy.
Yeah, well, you know, he was an inventor, like Ben Franklin. Anyways, he patented the idea in 1933, opened the first one on Admiral Wilson Boulevard in Pensauken back in 1933. Apparently, there's only one drive-in left in New Jersey today, the state that invented it. And it is in Vineland, New Jersey. It's called the Delsey Drive-In, and they have a double feature tomorrow, Cherry. Final Destination Bloodlines followed by Sinners. You can check that out tomorrow.
Oh, my goodness.
You like that?
I would see that double feature. I loved Sinners, and I would see it again, and I love the Final Destination series.
You do?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm surprised by that.
Why?
You're a, I didn't know you were, that's like a slasher horror type
of
thing.
No, but it's like, it is, but not really.
Yeah.
Yeah, it plays on like death coming to get you. Yeah, it's really cool. You should check it out.
Fun. Death coming to get you. That's how I want to spend my Friday night.
Yeah.
Anyways, drive-in movie theaters, you have a fondness for them, I believe.
I do. When I was a kid, I remember my mom and dad taking my brother and I to the drive-in. My aunt had an El Camino.
Oh, yeah.
This takes you back, right? Oh, little car truck.
The El Camino was great.
And it was kind of cool being a little kid watching the movie from the back of an El Camino.
I had a neighbor down the street, and the guy had like six El Caminos in various states of disrepair.
Mm-hmm.
And that's my memory of the El Caminos, just seeing them piled up in this guy's yard.
Because they're old and crusty dusty now. Yeah. And it was like brown, I remember. It wasn't the most attractive color, but hey, that's my driving memory.
Got the job done.
Got it done.
Coming up, stay tuned. We're talking to a legend. Dawn Staley from North Philadelphia, one of the most accomplished basketball people on the planet. That conversation's right around the bend. Stick with us on Studio 2.
Planet Money helps you understand the economy. We find the people at the center of the story.
Garbage in New York, that was like a controlled substance.
We show you how money influences everything.
Tell me what you like by telling me how you spend your money.
And we dig until we get answers.
I had a bad feeling you're going to bring that up.
Planet Money finds out. All you have to do is listen. The Planet Money Podcast from NPR.
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. Now, we could fill this whole hour just listing Dawn Staley's basketball mm-hmm. accomplishments. She won 3 gold medals as a player and a 4th as a coach. And as head coach at the University of South Carolina, she has already won 3 national championships while establishing the school as a perennial power. But before all those accolades, there was North Philadelphia and the Raymond Rosen Housing Projects.
Dawn Staley's new memoir takes readers back to her childhood neighborhood, a place she feels is misunderstood. Her book is called Uncommon Favor: Basketball, North Philly, My Mother, and the Life Lessons I Learned from All 3. We had a chance recently to chat with Coach Staley and ask her how a shy kid became the voice of the women's game. You were always like a quiet person off the court, but a leader on the court. What was it about basketball, the language of it, that you felt enabled you to speak in a way that you couldn't use language to do?
I think just being the youngest and not being able to have a perspective in my household because they didn't really listen to the youngest. I think when I got on the court, and I didn't speak a whole lot either. Mm-hmm. It was like my game spoke. When people saw me play, they spoke. They cheered. They were astonished that a girl could play as well as I could play. And that is kind of what I was chasing. Not necessarily playing to the crowd, but sometimes when you're on your journey, there are things that happen. There are people in your life that really inspire you and they give you stamina to continue. And it was the people in my neighborhood, the guys in my neighborhood. Once we got over that step of, you know, those old cliches, you should be in the kitchen. So all that, you know, once we got past that, I was welcomed in. They protected me.
Yeah.
They wouldn't let anybody or anything interfere with what they projected as, you know, my future.
Yeah.
And my future in basketball.
I love the way that you wrote about your neighborhood mm-hmm. in the book. I wanted to read an excerpt. You say, "It may have been rough around the edges, but we took care of each other. We looked out for each other. We planted flowers. We cultivated joy," talking about your block. I wonder what you want people to take away from this book about your neighborhood and neighborhoods like it.
Here's the thing. When you grow up in the projects, if you're not from that, if you don't know anything about the projects, if you just listen to people describe, you know, what growing up in poverty looked like in the housing projects where, you know, all the utilities are free, it's low rent, you would think it was probably the worst place that you could raise a family. And when I think it's the direct opposite. I am who I am today because of where I grew up. And not just my mother and my father and my household, because they were disciplinarians, mm-hmm. but the entire block, the entire neighborhood looked after each other. No adult would allow any young person to get out of line. And everybody had the authority to discipline. And no parent would ever argue with that.
Yeah.
Like never. So I think, you know, there are so many gems in growing up in the projects. My father was a handyman. He made fences. Like when you live in the projects, you try to make sure that you have, because everything is such a community that you want to feel like some parts of it is yours.
Yeah.
So we would actually, my father would build a fence that actually deterred people from coming down in front of our house. They had to go around, you know, in order to get to our house. Like, you know, who are we to do that? But he built it himself. Mm-hmm. There were fences around our lawns. You know, my father built all the fences in our block. My father was a mechanic. So anytime anybody's car, you know, wasn't working, he was there. Like,
it sounds like the neighborhood anyone would want to grow up in.
Exactly. And then, you know, there's the rough parts of the neighborhood too that raised me. Like, I know because of where I grew up, there isn't anything that anybody could throw at me. Like, I'm unshakable when it comes to that.
Yeah.
Like, there's not a big problem that's going to shake my ability to resolve the issue. I'm my best. I'm my best in worst situations. And that's all because of where I grew up.
Yeah. I want to ask you about your mom, because Miss Estelle, who you talk about in multiple places in the book, was a strong woman. She was a faithful woman. And you kind of start by telling us about her and the lesson she taught you. And that number one lesson was discipline. Can you talk about your mom a little bit and why this was the ultimate lesson that you think helped with your trajectory?
Super strong woman. Like, my mother had the strength of 10 men. And when I say that, physically, mentally, spiritually, she would not allow anything to deter her from raising her kids the right way, from going to church every Sunday, even if it caused my parents to be unequally yoked. She was going to do that. She knew where her strength was coming from. And it takes a strong-willed person, really, to choose God over everything.
Yeah, because your dad was not a churchgoer.
No, not my dad was a partier. My dad, you know, my dad did a lot of things, resourceful. I mean, my dad was a numbers runner.
Yeah.
That's you know, you can make on a big day. Now, he did share a little bit of that with us. Not very much of it, because he was pretty tight with his money, pretty tight, you know. And I mentioned this in the book where, you know, my mother and my father would take turns giving us our allowance. Each week, my mother had 1 week, my father had the next week, and they just would, you know, alternate. Well, sometimes my father would intentionally forget to leave
right,
the money.
Right, right.
Yeah, like, and we're looking around, like, where's the money? And then my mother would call back home after she left for work and said, did you guys get the money?
Right.
Yeah. And we're like, no. And she had hidden places where she left money. We had this little, like, entertainment bar-like thing, piece of furniture. Go lift the, you know, open the third drawer under two books inside on the 37th page. Like she would leave money all over the house because she just wanted to make sure we had everything that we needed.
Yeah.
And I may have mentioned this, but my mother sacrificed her needs to give her kids our wants. That's the type of woman that I grew up, you know, and being my shero.
Yeah. Your mom was a strict disciplinarian, but one rule that you often broke was the curfew because you was playing basketball. So I want you to take us to your neighborhood back in the day when you was playing. And one of the things you did was you would play with the boys all the time. And you actually say in the book, you did not see a gender difference in basketball. And that you, as a young girl, wanted to play in the NBA. You didn't see the difference. You were like, I'm about to ball up with all of y'all. And and I want to know, what was the moment that you realized that there was a difference?
Well, I would say this. You know, growing up where I grew up, it was an anomaly for a girl to play basketball just with the guys. Mm-hmm. It was uncommon. You know, it wasn't something that, you know, that people saw every day. you got to get through those old cliches of you need to be in the kitchen somewhere, go put on the skirt. I heard all of that. Like, it was really unoriginal, right? But, I mean, I thought I was taking basketball seriously, you know, the moment I picked it up. But it took a while for other people to take me seriously when it came to basketball. So when they started taking me seriously is when, you know, I felt like I arrived, because you want the people in your neighborhood to respect you. Like, that's the ultimate thing in growing up in the hood, is respect from your peers. Like, you want that, you know, and you want to earn it. Like, I had to earn it. I probably had to earn it more so than a guy, because I had the gender tag against me. Like, you're the only female. So I arrived when I was probably one of the first 10 that was picked to play.
Yeah, on the courts.
On the court.
Talking about earning respect.
Yeah.
I came across this headline when you were in eighth grade. And this is a headline from the Philadelphia Tribune. And I'm reading it verbatim. Star guard Dawn Staley may save the sport. Mm. Now, mind you, you were an eighth grader when this article came out in the Tribune. I am just, first of all, curious if you remember that story, but also what it was like for an introvert to get that type of attention as a teenager.
I mean, I was an introvert, but introverts don't mind seeing their name in the paper, right?
Yes, yes.
Right, that's our private time to kind of just watch. Nobody's around. You can just kind of be as one with the article.
Yeah.
But it's just that. Like, to grow up in Philly, to be in the eighth grade, to be in the, you know, the Tribune was a black paper.
Yep.
Yeah.
It was fulfilling, you know, because you know what type of work you put in. You know that for me, I wasn't even doing it for the headlines or the articles, anything like that. I play basketball. I coach basketball now for like I love it. Like, I love everything that basketball brings, the good, the bad, the ugly. And I feel like I owe basketball. Like, I'm forever indebted to the game. And I feel like, you know, every time that I'm doing something great in the sport, mm-hmm. I get rewarded. You want to make your city proud. You want to make your hood proud. Like, I'm from North Philly. Like, we specify the region in which we grow up. I'm from North Philly. And if you think about North Philly, if anybody thinks about North Philly, they probably, the first initial thought is bad neighborhood. Like, bad place to grow up. And I'm like, North Philly, like, North Philly is the place to be. You know, it is where you can learn some incredible life lessons that will carry you. I am as tough can be because of where I grew up. Like, I am, like, there isn't, again, I'll say it again, like, there isn't anything that I don't think I can accomplish. And I'm so happy that I'm able to have written a book to express it. Because I say it all the time. I say it on the stages of being at the Olympic Games. I'm from North Philly, like,
yeah.
North Philly zone. And to be able to put it in a book where not just a handful of people can read about it, they can really feel and take this journey with me. And it's normal. Like, it's not, I know I've had a story career when it comes to basketball, you know, but it's written as such that it applies to any profession, anything that you've gone through or are going through.
Yeah.
I do think it resonates with normal people. I live my life as a normal person, although there's some stardom and there's some, you know, name recognition. But at the end of the day, I lead a very simple life.
Yeah. I love that. And I think about the edge that North Philly gave you. I mean, you had a lot of success at Dobbins High School. Shout out to Dobbins. They named the gymnasium after you. That must have been an honor. And then you go outside of your comfort zone. You go to UVA, where your edge, your North Philly edge, was so sharp. You was like slicing people. Can you talk about like that transition coming out of your comfort zone in North Philly, having to, you know, then go to college and then see the world and with that edge? How did you sort of like calibrate yourself. Talk about the journey of like self-calibration when you come out of a place like North Philly that taught you so much, so many lessons, but then you have to learn different ones as you grow and expand.
You know, I love UVA, you know, as a choice of college, but I didn't really know. Like when you're on your visit at college, you're there for 48 hours and you spend a lot of time with the team and less time in the on the grounds, as we call them in UVA, in the grounds.
Not the campus, the grounds.
The grounds.
The grounds, I like yes. That. So once you're there, for me, I'm like, you know, I've never been around so many white people. Like North Philly in my neighborhood is like 102% black, mm-hmm. right? And I had a hard time acclimating, especially academically. I just didn't think I was prepared for, although I was a really good student in public school, going to UVA and the rigors of the academics was challenging. And I felt myself just not doing well and almost being kicked out of UVA. And I had to go in front of a dean and fall on the sword for her to allow me to stay. And I didn't do that. Like, you know, I was still very shy.
Yeah.
And sitting in front of the dean, you know, was very intimidating to me. You know, I didn't give eye contact. I didn't speak up for myself. I didn't do anything besides sit there and listen. And then a word came out of her mouth that, you know, I just strongly disagreed with. She said, "You're going to have to conform to the ways we do things here at UVA." And I'm like, "Conform?" You know, it's a nothing word to me today, right? It's nothing because I, you know, our players have to conform to the way we do things here at South Carolina and our program. So it's just a normal word for me today. But back then, I'm from North Philly. Like, we don't conform. Like, this is who we are. You know, take us or leave us. And my bubble was talking. That's what I would have said. But my bubble wasn't talking. I wasn't saying anything. I just sat there and listened. And the dean took that as I wasn't very serious about my dire situation. So my coach had to come back in and clean it up and find a way for me to stay. And then what I did was I just started competing in the classroom. Like I started tapping into the very thing of who I was as an athlete. There wasn't anything that I wouldn't do to beat my basketball opponent. Like if it required me to take extra shots, I would do that. If it required me to watch more film, I would do that. If it required me to sit on the bench, I would do that. If it required me to just be less of a shooter, more of a passer, I would do that. I would figure out a way. And I had, you know, game plans to do that. With academics, when I was not doing well, I just chalked it up of not doing well. I didn't compete. But the moment I started competing, like, I'm not going to let this person get a better score than I do. I'm not going to let this person outstudy me. And once I start acclimating and conforming to that in that way and competing in that way, I instantaneously became a better student in the classroom. I thank the dean for giving me that grace to grow up and to learn and to conform to the ways in which they do things at UVA. And now I'm a graduate of UVA, and no one can take that away from me.
Yeah, a proud graduate at that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's so interesting, that meeting you describe in the book where you basically don't say a word. And now to compare that to you now, mm-hmm. you are a coach. You are plenty loquacious.
Mm-hmm.
I am curious when that switch went off for you, where it's like, I could use my voice, my actual voice, to, first of all, advocate for myself and to uplift the people around me.
Yeah, I mean, life, you know what I'm saying?
Life.
It does, right? Like, I'm 18 years old going through that.
Yep.
My 18-year-old self to now, I would say I probably reached that point, well, probably before I was 50. But once I turned 50, it's like life clears up.
Really?
It really does. It does. It, wow. It clears up.
Something about 5-0.
Interesting.
Right, something about it. It gets you ready for 5-0. Like, you start to figure things out. you know, in your 20s, right? And then your 30s hit, you're like, okay, well, this is all right living, right? This is all right. But you still, you know, you would still take some hits somewhere along the lines. And then 40s was fun, right? And then you hit your 50s, like, okay, that didn't sound right. So let me, it's a look, sound, feel type of thing. If something looks, sounds, or feels off, I'm going to address it. If it looks, sounds, or feels great, I'm going to encourage it. And that is kind of how I navigate life.
I think about your North Philly roots and who you are with that edge from North Philly. And I also think about the lesson you learned at UVA and then the lessons you kept learning, because there were some losses you had. You didn't make the 92 Olympic team. You missed the shot that would have won the title when you were in college. You had to come home for a moment and work in retail. And there was some, we had to throw that one in there. We were both like, book, whoa.
I was just, my jaw dropped when I read that.
We were like, Stanley worked at retail?
But you were the best player, the collegiate player in the country. And just to give people a sense of where women's basketball was at that time, after your senior year, you come back to Philly and you work a retail job initially because you can't get a job playing pro ball. You do eventually. But I mean, first of all, do you remember where was the retail job? And also just take us to your mindset in that moment.
Yeah. The background of that story was my mother, who was cleaning houses for some rich people, right, who owned the store. I didn't have a job. So I, you know, she was like, you want a job? I can ask. I forget his name. Well, cool dude. He was a cool dude. And he got me a job at, I forget the name of the store, but it was at Franklin Mills Outlets.
Okay.
It was at the Outlets.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So I worked there for about 3 weeks, and I'm still am a heck of a folder. Like, I would, I didn't mind folding the clothes. I mean, I would run from the customers now. I wasn't one of those greeters where, you know, can I help you? No, I'm running from the customers. I'll go behind them after they looked at a, you know, a clothing item, and I will go fold it back or put it nicely on the hanger. And then I got the check after working 3 weeks. I don't know. I think it was $227. And I'm like, for 3 weeks?
Yeah.
So I immediately put in my letter of resignation. And I said, I'm just going to work on my game. I just put the heat on my agent to find me a job. But at that time, you know who my male counterpart was?
Christian Laettner, I'm guessing.
No.
Larry Johnson. Okay.
Wow.
UNLV.
Million.
UNLV.
Yeah, he got $80 million.
Yeah.
Wow.
And you were basically looking for a job, and you get one in, it's Segovia is the name of the town in Spain?
Segovia, Spain, yes.
Man, Segovia, Spain in the early 90s. Did you speak any Spanish?
No.
Not a lick?
Not a lick. I spoke basketball.
Yeah.
And that was understood. That was understood.
But the lessons you had to learn, because you seem to thrive when you are down. So you had to go work retail. You didn't, couldn't, they told you you couldn't come to the Olympics because you didn't have enough international experience.
Yep.
And you just, it's like you just dug in and got it done. What is that switch that you have in you that when you don't get something that you tried for, when a lot of people stay down, it just seemed like it just made you work harder.
My second nature is to be challenged. Again, when you're over 50, you have reflection. So when I reflect on my career and my life, every time that I've had some type of disappointment or some type of failure or some type of loss, it seemed to be what I really needed in my life at that time. Mm. You don't really understand it when you're going through it. You know, we just lost to UConn this year in the national championship game, right? So am I upset? Yeah, I don't like to lose. But at the same time, I know what a dominant team looked like. And UConn was that this year.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I know what we need to work on and where our pitfalls were. So we've done some things in this offseason to help that. So if we're ever put in that situation again, we can right that wrong. But again, now that I'm over 50 and I've been through some things, I understand that this is a failure, this is a loss, this is a disappointment. But how we come back from those things throughout, like historically speaking, I mean, I like our chances moving forward. I do.
You mentioned the pay inequity between you and your male counterpart when you graduated from UVA. Mm-hmm. And I get the sense that pay inequity really pisses you off at a core mm-hmm. level. You talk about it in the book and in negotiating your own contract at South Carolina. But I wanted to bring up maybe on the bright side of this conversation, there was a piece just came out in the New York Times about one of your former players, one of your great stars, Aja Wilson, getting a shoe deal. It took a long time, but that is now, and the story is about sort of how that evolved and the fact that it took longer than people wanted it to take. And yet it's also arrived for her. I'm curious what you make of her having a signature shoe, which is a huge thing in the basketball world, and what lessons you take away from the journey it took to get there. You're watching from the outside as an observer, right? But that journey mm-hmm. to get to that place for her, because she is probably the best player in the world.
Well, I'll say this. Like, I knew before the public knew that she was getting a signature shoe, right? Aja knew before the public knew that she was getting a signature shoe. So a signature shoe takes at least a minimum of 18 months, a minimum. So you don't want to tell people you got a signature shoe coming out and they got to wait 2 years to get the shoe.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yep.
But it goes to show that the power of the push, like the public push, people wanted to know why Aja didn't have a shoe already when the shoe was already being in, you know, in the process of her creating it and talking with the designer. I couldn't say anything, but I knew. Like, I knew the process, but the public made Nike come out probably a lot sooner than they wanted to come out to say she got the shoe, mm-hmm. right? It sold out within 5 minutes of being on the, you know, being released. I was in Vegas and I went to the, you know, the Nike store. I bought a whole lot of stuff. You know, there wasn't, right. I had to beat the crowd in there, but then by the time I turned my back, the whole rack is gone.
Yeah. Oh, you don't get a special shipment of the Aja?
It seemed like you should have had it delivered.
Yeah,
like,
come on now.
Come on.
That's true. That's true. But no, I want to support. Like, I put my credit card down and I'm like, I'm going to support Aja in this way. I mean, it's only right that we give the people what they deserve to get. Women should not have to take a back seat to any of it. Like, you know, give us our worth.
That was North Philadelphia's Dawn Staley. On the other side of this break, we'll talk more about pay equity in women's sports, and we'll hear what kind of role could lure Coach Staley back to the WNBA.
And we want to hear from you. Do you have any personal memories with Philly's Dawn Staley at Temple in North Philly? Give us a call, 888-477-9499, or email studio2@whyy.org. Got to read this great story from Leroy.
I love that story. Go ahead.
Leroy says, I remember getting lit up by Dawn and one of her classmates from Dobbins one summer on the playground. She was gracious in victory then, which is rare in playground ball. Her special qualities were so totally on display.
Wow, Leroy, a.k.a. Old Head.
He called himself Old Head. I like that.
I love that. That's a wonderful story. She talked about playing, you know, on the courts in her North Philly neighborhood with the guys and just being welcomed into the game. I really enjoy talking to Dawn Staley.
That's how champions are made. We're mm-hmm. going to hear a lot more from Dawn Staley on the other side of this break. Stick with us. You are listening to Studio 2 on WHYY. And welcome back to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Now, let's continue our conversation with Philadelphia native Dawn Staley, who will be back in town tomorrow to discuss her new book, Uncommon Favor, Basketball, North Philly, My Mother, and the Life Lessons I Learned from All Three.
Back in 2021, Coach Staley signed a record-setting contract extension with the University of South Carolina that paid her $22 million. It made her the highest-paid black coach in the sport, and crucially, it guaranteed a salary similar to what the school paid its men's coach.
I want to ask, first of all, shout out to you because in 1999, you became the first black woman basketball player to get her own signature Nike. You had the Air Zoom S5, which is a really cute shoe, by the way. It was super fly. But I want to ask you about standing on business when it came to pay equity. You decided that this last contract, this was going to be the time that you were going to stand up. What was it like, you know, using your voice in that way and knowing that it could have a ripple effect and it would have a ripple effect throughout the entire sport and athletics generally?
Well, I actually asked for equal pay in 2021. Mm-hmm. So that would put me still over 50, right? I'm over 50. And something just didn't seem right because here I am on a national stage. There was a discrepancy on in 2021 at the Final Four, actually the NCAA tournament, men's and women's, where the men's tournament was held in Indianapolis. Our tournament was held in San Antonio. You know, one of the women players made a post comparing the weight rooms,
yeah,
right? And she put that post out. And it sent everybody into a tizzy. And then we were able to put out a letter, an open letter, just stating that we strongly disagree with what's happening. So I'm fighting a fight on the national level. I come back home after being in the Final Four. And I'm like, we're at a point where it was time for me to renegotiate. And I'm like, now is the time. If I can fight for, you know, equity in our game on a national level, I certainly can fight for it, you know, and on the local level where I work. And I asked my agent to stand down because I didn't think he could do it because he had been through so many other negotiations that they get to a place where, you know, they created a friendship or relationship and our AD would get to a point where he's just like, okay, we don't have any money, right? And then the agent is easy going to say, they don't have any more money. And I could say, okay, well, we'll take it. Well, I didn't want him to negotiate because I didn't want to get to that point. Mm-hmm. So I hired a local lawyer who was connected with pretty much the decision makers. And because I did that, it took about 5 to 6 months in order for them to agree on the terms. And then stuff in between, you know, I would have conversations with the AD. He would call me about something else, and then somehow the negotiations would come up in our conversations. And I'm like, okay, well, you know, he was like, you're going to leave that much money on the table? And I was like, well, no, I'm not going to leave it on the table, but we're not far off from where I need to be. So if you can put that amount on the table, you can put a couple of dollars more, and then we can be done with it. And it's good for all of us.
And you did not relent. Really, yeah, you did not relent.
Yeah, because it wasn't really, the fight wasn't really for me. I was making a lot of money, but I'm like, I'm looking at my male counterpart who hadn't had the type of success that we've had. Not half as good, not a quarter as good of seasons that we've had. And I'm just like, he gets a pay increase more than me, not just the salaries, just the pay increase of his contract was up and he got, I don't know how much it was, but it was more than what I got. And I'm just like, I think that's embarrassing to me, you know, for that to happen. And I didn't want to sit around and think, you know, that I'm okay with it. So we fought for it and we got it. And I do think it was a great thing for our athletics department, our university, the state of South Carolina, to be out front and giving equal pay where it was deserved.
You know, going back to that headline I brought up earlier from the mid-80s about how you may save the sport and you were in eighth grade at the time, I feel like there has been this narrative about women's basketball for decades that it's always on the precipice, it needs to be saved. And I think the question is, have we finally past the tipping point where we're not talking about saving the sport. We're talking about a thriving sport that is a commercial powerhouse. Not just Asia Wilson, not just Caitlin Clark. We got Angel Reese, Paige Beckers, whoever you want to name. Like, have we reached that point in your mind where you're like, this is not going anywhere. This is a commercial and athletic force that no one needs to save anymore.
Yeah, we're busting at the seams, women's basketball. Like, it is in high demand. I wish we could get out of our television deal. I wish we could stand on our own as a sport, and we're shown our true value. Like, our true value. Our true value is not being valued because the TV deal is women's basketball and all the other Olympic sports are included in that number. So we don't know what our true number is. And I do think, you know, the ESPNs of the world and the decision makers of women's basketball knew they need to lock us in that type of deal, because if they didn't, they would have to be dishing out a lot more.
Yeah.
But it's coming. Yeah. I do. There's no turning back, because I think we've been held back for a long time, like a long, long, long time. I never get this. Like, it almost seems like our money isn't green. Like, women's basketball money isn't green, because we don't want to, we're pouring resources in, but we also are being held back and not giving our true value. So at some point we will be valued in a way. And I do think we can have as lucrative deals, salaries, resources, and all that comes with being, you know, a great product.
And I got to ask you this question because, you know, the WNBA has been expanding a little bit, and Philadelphia, there's been rumors percolating about us getting a team one day. And, you know, the dream coach would be you. Miss North Philly herself. I mean, would you ever, I know you love South Carolina and you've been very successful there, but would you ever consider at some point, if we got a team here, being in Philly? Of coaching, a WNBA
or ownership,
team in Philly,
ownership.
Or ownership.
Ownership, that's what we're talking. I want to be ownership. I don't necessarily want to be on the sideline. I think my true passion is for young people on the collegiate level.
Yeah.
I'm here to make sure our league is in a safe place to just harness and hone the skills of collegiate players, so when they go to the next level, when they go to the WNBA, then our league is in a good place. Mm-hmm. But I think ownership is the place to be. Mm.
And you would do that. You would be interested in that in Philly.
I would definitely be interested in ownership.
All right.
Real quick, Do you have the voice, the line, the connections to be part of those negotiations to get a team to Philly? Is your voice in that room? Do you want your voice to be in that room?
Yeah, I've had some conversations with people.
All right.
Yeah. Well, fingers crossed.
We'll leave it at that.
We want this team here so bad, and we'll leave it there.
Okay. We got to get our Sixers going too. Now
that is going. Another hour of conversation.
Yes, right.
We would have to do.
Thank you so much, Dawn Staley. The book is Uncommon Favor, and it's a great read. And I have to say, if you live in Philadelphia, that first part of the book is just meat for you, because there's so much Philadelphia in the 1980s that just takes you right there. So thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much.
And that was our conversation with Coach Dawn Staley. Her book, Uncommon Favor, Basketball, North Philly, My Mother, and the Life Lessons I Learned from All Three, is out now. And she's going to be in Philly tomorrow,
yes,
Friday at 7 p.m. at the Enon Tabernacle Baptist Church on West Cheltenham Avenue.
Yeah. Do we have time, do you think?
For a call? I guess there is a caller here on the line. Here's Nancy from Mount Airy on line two. Sure. Let's bring on Nancy real quick, Nancy.
Nancy, quickly, okay. Your comment.
Okay, Nancy Clady. I taught at Williamson High School when Dawn was at Dobbins. She would come into our high school often to see our basketball coach. I taught dance. I was a teacher along with Dee Faison. I would kiss her and say, please come into the dance studio. I can teach you how to dance. She said, oh, no. I couldn't do that. But we all know that Dawn can do anything.
Yeah.
And she probably doesn't remember me, but I remember her and always, always, always tell my friends about her.
Great memory. Great memory from Nancy in Mount Airy. We appreciate that. And really enjoyed that conversation, Cherry, by the way. And it did make me think, you know, this WNBA team in Philadelphia might happen.
So bad.
I think it should be called the Philadelphia Freedom. That's been my pitch for a long time.
That's a really cool name. There's so many options. There people talk about, I just want it to, whatever they call it.
Sure.
I want it to come, and I hope we're able to broadcast live from there the first game. I'm putting it out there.
Speaking of live broadcast, yes. We have one tonight in Wilmington, Delaware. You can still join us for our conversation with former governor and now mayor John Carney tonight at 6, Theater N in Wilmington, Delaware. Go to whyy.org/events for all those juicy details.
Yeah, but before we jump into the car, we get to reveal our DJ of the day. The DJ of the day is Susan B, who picked Respect.
Yes.
R-E-S-P-E-C-T by the one and only Aretha Franklin. Susan says she has earned it in all aspects of her life and in the global sports community. Kudos to Susan.
Let's hear it. And let's thank our lovely team just a little bit.
Thank you, team, yes.
Debbie Builder, Paige Marie Bessler, and Andreas Copes produced this show. Mike Schiffler is our visual producer. Al Banks and Tina Calique engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCory. Joan Isabella is WHYY's audio general manager from Studio 2 at WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arrant.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Thank you so much for joining us.